Hello and welcome to the Women in Sport podcast. Our vision is that no one is excluded from the joy, fulfillment and lifelong benefits of sport. It's July 2024 and this year marks Women in Sport's 40th anniversary. In the second of two special episodes, we're previewing the Olympic Games 2024 in Paris by looking back at games of the past with Olympians who've been there, got the tracksuit and of course the medal. In the case of my guest in this episode, two gold medals, one from her home games, London 2012, and the other from Rio 2016, both in cycling's team pursuit. Now, add to that five World Championship titles, multiple World Cup gold medals, and a standing world record, also in team pursuit. Few of us will ever know what it's like to represent our country in elite sport. Fewer still will know the feeling of standing on the podium with the national anthem playing. Joanna Rousell, MBE, knows exactly what that's like. My name is Julia George. I'm a journalist, broadcaster and former gymnast. Welcome to the Women in Sport podcast. Joanna Rousell, welcome to the Women in Sport podcast. So let's go straight to London 2012. Did you feel the significance at the time in that team pursuit final, or was it just another race?
In the moment, I would say just another race. And I'd say that's how I prepared for it. Up to that point, my whole career had been about London 2012. I'd been a full-time cyclist for 6 years at that point. So everyone always thinks of Olympic cycles as 4 years, which of course they are, but I hadn't been part of the team for Beijing. I was only 19 back in 2008, so well, let me off for that one. But it was all about London 2012. And the way I prepared for it, the way I dealt with the nerves and pressure that obviously came with going in, we were the favourites going into our event. It was a home Olympic Games. There was so much hype around it. My way of dealing with it was, it's just another race. It's still 12 laps of a velodrome. Velodrome is 250-metre wooden bowl. I need to do 12 laps as fast as I can. I'm racing against all the girls that I've raced against for the last however many years around the world at various different competitions. This is just another race. And it wasn't until, not even in the initial moments afterwards, but really like in the sort of hours afterwards, I really realised quite how big a deal it was. So a few people had said to us beforehand about sort of deleting social media off your phone for the duration of the games and trying to shut off from social media. I hadn't taken that advice. Had everything still on my phone. So this was a little bit before Instagram, but Twitter was big, Facebook was big. Went on my phone after the podium ceremony and everything, and it had thousands of notifications from people, random people sending me messages on social media, people that I used to know, relatives that I'd never spoken to that were apparently related to me, school friends from primary school, loads of people getting in contact that were not at all cycling fans, not even really sports fans, that had followed the Olympics and watched us and seen us win. And I was like, oh, okay, that was not just another race. That was something different entirely.
What is it about the Olympics that makes everybody suddenly a sports fan? Everybody suddenly championing Team GB?
So what I found sort of in my travels and my life since doing two Olympics, wherever you go in the world, everyone understands what the Olympics is, even if they don't follow the sport that you do or even understand the sport that you do. And you say to them, I'm a team pursuiter, that means nothing to them. But you say I'm an Olympic gold medalist, that means something. Even if you say I'm a professional cyclist or professional athlete, still a little bit of a sort of question mark about what exactly is that, especially as a female athlete. But you say I'm an Olympic champion, everybody gets it. And then you've got these 2 weeks of really intense sport across multiple channels. There's so many things on at the same time, and we all just love getting behind our nation or whoever is the underdog in whatever event you're watching. And there's always a fantastic story, there's always the underdog story, there's always the big nations trying to go out there and top the medal table. And whatever, even if you're not into a specific sport, you can still get behind your country and where they stand on the medal table. And I just think there's something for everybody at the Olympics, and everybody gets it worldwide. Everybody talks about it. It's hard to ignore. It was obviously hard to ignore in London, being here in a home event on our time zone. It dominates those 2 weeks in August every cycle.
You were in a bubble though at London 2012. Most of us watched the London opening ceremony, the incredible Danny Boyle opening ceremony. You were nowhere near. I mean, you said to me recently, it was just not
a consideration that you go to the opening ceremony?
Yeah, so when the opening ceremony was on, we were in what's called a holding camp in Newport in South Wales. So there is a velodrome in Newport. At the time in 2012, there were only three indoor velodromes in the country. So one in Manchester, which is where we were based for our training, the one in London, which was, you know, ready for the Olympics, and then one in Newport in South Wales. So we were over in Newport, staying in a lovely hotel and in a holding camp. So basically that means you just 100% focused on your training. You eat, sleep, train, repeat for 2 weeks solid. And that is where the form really comes. That is really sort of the magic time when you haven't got to worry about cooking and cleaning and all the other sort of normal day-to-day life things, purely just eat, sleep, train, repeat. And we were there when the opening ceremony was on. I remember watching it from the hotel room, and I was actually in a hotel room on my own for that holding camp, which is quite rare. Normally you're sharing a room with somebody. I didn't have my own hotel room then, and yeah, just sat on my own watching it. Did sort of message a couple of my teammates, but yeah, completely detached from it. And then we travelled over to London a couple of days later.
One of your teammates though was the flag carrier, Sir yep. Chris Hoy, plain Chris Hoy as he was at the time. Mm-hmm. They helicoptered him.
Yes. So there was sort of a vote among who we wanted to be the flag bearer for Team GB at the opening ceremony. And Chris ended up winning the vote, unsurprisingly. And obviously, like I said, we were over in Newport. We weren't due to travel over to London for another couple of days. So yeah, he apparently got a helicopter over there. He was the flag bearer. And like I say, it wasn't even a consideration to be a part of it for us because we were so focused on our training. And the helicopter, sorry, for Chris, it's all about not spending time getting on a train, doing unnecessary walking. We say as a cyclist, like, don't stand when you can sit, don't sit when you can lie, don't lie when you can sleep. So you don't really want to just like casually pop over to London to carry a flag around an opening ceremony. Obviously it's a huge honour, and obviously he did it, but yeah, taking a helicopter over, I'm sure, sort of eased the pressure on the legs so he could continue resting as much as possible.
Let's talk about the race itself, the final race. Unlike lots of events, you were racing twice in short succession, weren't you? Did you have to prepare differently for that?
Yeah, so normally at a World Championships, we have a qualifier and a final on the same day. At the Olympic Games, there were three rounds of racing, so a qualifier on one day, a semi-final and final the next day. There was about an hour and a half between the semi-final and the final. We'd expected it to be about an hour, so we knew it would be really, really tight turnaround. And for the event that I did, it's like absolutely full gas. You practically need carrying off your bike when you finish the event, you know, full of lactic acid. To then get back on and do it an hour later is just what nobody at all wants to do. But that was the nature of the Olympic programme. So we had prepared for that in training. We knew that we'd have these two big rides back to back. I think a different challenge for me was having the qualifier on the first day. And normally, once you get your qualifying ride done, you're so much more relaxed. You're like, okay, this is where we stand. Then you've got your final a few hours later. But we had a whole 24 hours to, you know, go back to the village, try and relax, try not to overthink it all, try not to overanalyze everybody else's performance, and then go back and do it all again a second day. So I think had it all been in one day, that would have been a little bit easier. But no, spread over 2 days.
What do you remember about the final race?
So first of all, we had four riders as part of our squad for a three-rider team, which is common. You know, you travel with a reserve. We didn't travel with a team and a reserve. We traveled with a team of four, and we officially got the nod of the three of us that would be in the final at an hour to go before the start, because that is the limit that they have to change the team. So at an hour to go, I officially got that nod. Yeah, you're definitely in the team. And that was the first time I thought about actually trying to win the gold medal, because up until then, it had all been about preparing as well as I could, doing everything I could to be in the team, do the best job I could possibly do. So that was the first point I was like, oh, we need to try and win this. I don't remember feeling nervous sat on the start line. The only real memory I have was on the last lap, we won the event by 6 seconds, which is a huge margin. It actually wasn't a particularly interesting race to watch because we won it by quite so much. And the nature of team pursuiting is you're chasing the opposite team. In an ideal world, you catch the opposite team and you'd win, but that very rarely happens at that sort of level. But I remember on the last lap, I could see the Americans who we were chasing because we were gaining on them so much, and my thought was, nobody fall off, like, please just everybody stay on your bikes, nobody fall. We have got this, we can cruise this last lap, we have easily won this. And that was my thought, like, nobody fall off right now. I think it was one of those races that just went perfectly, like completely in the zone, in that flow state, and yeah, we took the win.
Talk to me about standing on the podium. I mentioned it in the introduction. I well up when I see somebody from my country on the podium, the flag going up, the national anthem playing. What is it like to be that person?
Yeah, really good question. So I've often seen people on the podium crying. I always thought I would be that person. I've often thought, you know, before a race, you know, various races in my career, like, if I win this, I'm going to be in floods of tears if we actually pull this off. And I remember being on the podium and not feeling at all like that, not feeling in a little bit even close to crying, and just sort of massive smile on my face, trying to take it all in, trying to remember everything. It all happens so quickly between finishing the race and having the podium ceremony. So in cycling, that all happens probably within the space of less than an hour. And, you know, you finish the race, you go straight through to the mix zone, do some interviews, and very quickly you're whisked into a sort of room out the back, and then you're taken onto the podium. So you barely get a chance to take breath. I've done solo events at World Championships, Commonwealth Games, etc., and been on the podium by myself. And that feels quite a lonely experience in comparison to being up there with your teammates, which I think is really, really nice. And both the Olympic Games that I did were team events. And I think it's lovely to be up there with people rather than on your own. Like, okay, yay me, I did well. It's nice to be up there as a team.
Okay, in front of you, two Olympic gold medals. I've never seen one before. I held them before we started recording the podcast. They're blooming heavy.
Yep.
Shall we just pick it up? Let's have a little, just talk us through this.
So the gold medals from London and Rio, they're both not solid gold, unfortunately. Silver gold plated, I'm told, so not worth too much if you were trying to.
You're not going to sell them, though, are you?
Not going to do it anyway, but that's often people's question, like, oh, how much is it worth? But they both have on the front the Greek goddess of victory, Nike. So that's the same on the front of both medals. Then on the back, they've got the logo for each game. So the London one has also got the London logo plus the River Thames sort of running through the middle. It's also got the event engraved along the bottom. And they both weigh about half a kilo. The Rio one is slightly heavier. I have weighed them because it probably didn't have anything more interesting to do than weighing my medals. The London one is in far better condition. The Rio one is got quite a few scratches on, which is strange given it the London one is 4 years older. But I'm more than happy to take them out and about, people to hold them, wear them, have photos with them, that sort of thing. I'd far prefer them to go out and about than be locked away at home.
We've already done all of the photos today because we're all so excited to see them. It's fantastic. I'm going to go back in time, if I may. Little Jo, did she ever dream? Did she even think about being an Olympic champion when you were a primary school age child?
So primary school age, I'd say yes. So I've thought about this a lot recently, and I would say at primary school, I would have identified as sporty. I used to really enjoy sports day. I used to compete in swimming outside of school up to county level. I used to do biathlon, so swimming and running up to national level. And I used to be fascinated by the Olympics. I have vague memories of watching the Sydney Olympics and sort of, you know, vaguely seeing sort of people win medals for Team GB and being fascinated by the whole thing.
You now work for Women in Sport, and you know as well as I do that we have a massive issue with girls dropping out of sport, typically in their teenage years. Could you have been one of those girls? You're very academic. You go off to grammar school in Surrey, where you were growing up. And does sport disappear off the radar, or at least become less important in those early teenage years for you?
Yeah, definitely. So I would say at secondary school, I wouldn't have called myself one of the sporty ones at all. I'd stopped swimming. I used to swim for a swimming club when I was at primary school. I just stopped that. And looking back on reflection, I think I was close to being one of those stats of one of those teenage girls that are sort of disengages with sport that used to be sporty. And by the time I was sort of halfway through secondary school, I did no sport outside of school. I did PE. I used to represent the school at cross country, mainly because I think nobody else wanted to do it. But apart from that, I was doing no other form of sport or exercise outside of PE.
You joke about not having, we were going to have a rounders day, weren't we, for our summer social at Women in Sport, and you said, don't expect anything very much from me because I've got no hand-eye coordination.
No, I'm no good if it involves hitting a ball, throwing, catching, kicking, anything like that. Honestly, that's not my area. Okay. So you'll be very, very underwhelmed.
One day at secondary school, you miss a double maths lesson, and that changes your life forever. Why did you miss that double maths lesson?
It certainly did. So it was when I was at the end of year nine, so this was 2003, and British Cycling were on the lookout for new future talents ahead of future Olympic Games. So at this point, we didn't know that London would have the 2012 Games. We knew London was bidding for it. We knew that some of the Olympic quotas were changing for cycling. So we knew that there were going to be new events coming in for Beijing in terms of BMXing. And British Cycling knew they had a bit of a lack of a talent pool, especially on the women's side. So they went out to do talent ID tests across the country, trying to look for new future talent, boys and girls, but particularly girls, because that was where they really sort of lacked in terms of the talent coming through cycling clubs. So the local talent ID coach rung up my school and said, can I come along and do some talent ID tests on your school playing field? Apparently he rung lots of schools and lots of schools turned him away and said, no, we're far too busy. My school said yes, and they ran some talent ID tests on the playing field. I wasn't especially good. I think I was officially third best at my school, but I won my race. That we had like six girls per race, and I won my race. We had six laps of the playing field for an endurance test, and we had a sprint across the field for the sprint test. I remember getting a bit scared towards the end of the sprint, because I was sort of coming up towards the fence at the edge of the field, and I slammed on the brakes just before the finish line because I was like, I don't think I can stop before the fence. It would have been completely fine, but I was a very nervous cyclist back then.
What did they see in you?
So at that point, I think they purely just took the fastest times from each school. I got invited back for more testing on a static bike. That was far more scientific. So there was a 3-minute full gas test, which, to be honest, on reflection, I just think I paced it well. So if you're on a bike, you know, a static bike of any kind at the gym or whatever, and you've got to do 3 minutes full gas, I think a lot of people think, oh, that's really short, and that they hit it really hard and sort of die a slow and painful death sort of after about 20 seconds. It's actually a very long time to go full gas for. And I think I sort of realised that, I don't know how, and paced my 3 minutes really well. We also had some sprint tests, again, measuring peak power output. They measured our height and weight, worked out power to weight ratio. So very, it's like numbers based at that point. And I was sort of hadn't good enough numbers to get invited for a third stage of testing. But the third stage of testing was a mountain bike ride around Epping Forest. So I turned up with my bike, my pink bike with the tassels and whatever, thinking it was appropriate for riding off-road, having no idea that it wasn't. We were offered bikes. They did say, like, if you haven't got an appropriate bike, we can provide one. I was like, no, I've got a bike, I'm fine. We were also offered cycling kit, and I, not knowing anything about cycling, I turned up in just like tracksuit bottoms and trainers. Tracksuit bottoms got caught in my chain and ripped to pieces. So I was offered like cycling shorts and everything, but I thought I don't need that. Turned up at Epping Forest, and everyone else there was either already involved in a cycling club or had some sort of connection with cycling, perhaps through a parent. So everyone had all the gear. Everyone had, you know, nice mountain bikes. I think I had a pink helmet or maybe a purple helmet as well. I just did not look the part whatsoever. And we had this mountain bike ride around the forest, and we were put in a buddy system. And so I was partnered with a guy who went on to be a professional cyclist, Alex Dowsett, and no hard feelings against him whatsoever, but we were in this buddy system and told just to like look after your buddy for this mountain bike ride. Within approximately 30 seconds, I think we went up the first hill and he was long gone, and I was off my bike and pushing it up the hill because my bike was not suitable whatsoever. That day in Epping Forest was absolutely horrible. I remember it pouring with rain. This was like December at this point. Muddy, horrible. I think on reflection, I could have easily said, what the hell am I doing here? Got off the bike, chucked it in the bush and walked away. I'd somehow still dragged myself around and got to the end of it.
That's what took you to the Olympics. Your raw talent, which they spotted, your tenacity. After London 2012, you have to dig deep and decide to go again. Mm-hmm. You're the Olympic champion. You're the world record holder. And by 2014, you've won everything you could possibly win. Why did you keep going then?
I have huge respect for athletes that go to multiple Olympic Games, you know, sort of five games. So Steve Redgrave, you know, amazing and really, really impressive.
Tessa Sanderson, six.
Yes.
Who's in our other Olympic podcast.
Even more impressive. But that was the first point where I was like, what do I do now? One of the motivations for carrying on was that the event, the team pursuit that I'd done and won in London, had changed from a 3-kilometre event with 3 riders to a 4-kilometre event with 4 riders. There was already a new challenge there, so that motivated me. But definitely my motivation going into Rio was different. I was keen to defend the title. So at that point, I believe no British female cyclist had ever defended an Olympic title. And very few British women had defended an Olympic title. We've had lots of success at the same games. For example, Becky Adlington, 2 golds in Beijing. Kelly Holmes, 2 golds in Athens. But very few women have been able to go back and defend it. So that was a motivation as well. And also at that point, I was that close to Rio. You know, we were less than 2 years out. I was like, I'm, you know, fully in the system and I'm keen to give the 4K team pursuit a go. But yeah, I've never been the sort of person that thought I want to try and go to 5, 6, however many games. It was always a sort of, I guess, a shorter term thing for me.
Was it more difficult, Rio?
Rio was a lot more difficult in a lot of ways. So first of all, being an Olympic champion, everything changes. I hear so many athletes say, like, oh, nothing's changed. but you'll still get more media requests, you've got more sponsorship commitments. Whenever you go to an event, you're announced as an Olympic champion. There's always that little bit extra that you need to do every time you go somewhere to compete. There's always that extra interview, that extra little bit of a spotlight. And going into Rio as the defending champions, there was almost the expectation that we would win. And the difficult thing going into Rio was at the World Championships earlier that year, we'd actually got the bronze. We weren't the world record holders. So for us, it was a very different run-in.
Injuries?
Me personally, it sounds ridiculous now, I was the wrong side of 25, which it felt at that point that, I know I sound really silly saying that now, but it felt like I just got a lot more injuries, a lot more illnesses, a little bit slower to recover as well. So you have a team training plan, and it felt like when I was younger, you train one day, recover overnight, train again the next day, no problem. And it felt as I was getting older, sort of going now towards late 20s, I needed that little bit longer to recover. We'd have a big training camp or a big gym block, a big strength block, and I just need an extra couple of days recovery compared to some of my younger teammates, which you can't really have, because when you're training for a team event, you know, the training plan carries on. You can't just take 2 days out of it. Yeah, exactly. And you know, unless you really need to, or you're injured or you're ill.
Also, Rio was a very different event. It's not home games. You had amazing facilities at London 2012, didn't you? And you get to Rio and the lifts aren't working in the flat. Your laundry goes missing. And you said to me in a previous conversation we had, I was on edge the whole time.
That was really tricky because there were a lot of things that were out of my control in Rio, but that felt like should be in my control. Things like a lot of the food wasn't very good in the food hall in the athletes' village. There were a couple of times when I got a chicken breast and cut into it and it was raw in the middle, and you think, oh god, like the last thing I need now is food poisoning. There were swimming pools in the Olympic village. We were told not to go in them because there was a risk of infection. There's a laundry system at any major games where you scan your accreditation and scan a barcode on your laundry bag. That seemed to crumble at some point, and some of the laundry went missing, which you're really like, kind of need my GB kit to racing. Now you can't race in some plain kit that you've got in your bag. So there was a lot of little things like that that weren't in my control, but there were things I could have done in terms of a lot of the girls brought with them like pots of porridge where they could just add water, or pots of pasta where they could just add boiling water and sort some meals out like that. And I think having had such a positive experience in London where everything had been perfect in the village, I didn't want for anything, that I perhaps hadn't come to Rio quite so prepared. In a way, I guess it stopped me thinking about the race so much. I think one of the worst things you can do is really overthink the actual bike race. At the end of the day, it was, well, in Rio, 16 laps of the track as fast as we could. Simple as that.
You've got the Rio gold in front of you as well. Is that harder earned? Is that more precious in some ways because of those obstacles and the challenges of the second Olympics?
Definitely. So everybody always asks, what is the favourite medal? And I think everybody always expects me to say the London one because that was the home games and that was the first one. And I think there's always the expectation of going and doing it a second time is easier. But I do think going and doing it a second time is far harder. And that is why it is quite rare for people to be able to defend Olympic titles across the board. So I'm more proud of the Rio medal just because of the various hurdles along the way. And also just tougher competition from around the world. Like, we were really pushed. Going to the final from the semi-finals, we'd qualified 0.2 seconds quicker than the Americans who we were up against in the final. And like, that is nothing. So you're sat on the start line of the Olympic final thinking, if I mess up a tiny bit here, 0.2 seconds is the blink of an eye, like that's an Olympic gold medal gone. Whereas in London, although it didn't feel like it at the time, we had such a huge buffer over our nearest rivals. It really was, you know, we would have had to have messed up quite badly to have lost that.
What did you say to your coach about your bike after the finals in Rio?
Yeah, so after the finals in Rio, I was sat in dope control for a while because I'm not known for my ability to wee quickly. So you have to do a sample in a pot under supervision, under sort of somebody watching.
Glamorous.
You. Yeah, that's part of the glamorous part of the sport. And we'd been cycling to and from the velodrome from the Olympic Village, and my coach messaged me like, are you any close to going? And I was like, no, it's going to be a long one, I'm sorry. And he was like, can I ride your bike back to the village? And I was like, yeah, do what you like with it. Like, I don't want to see it again. Like, I'm not planning on getting on that bike anytime soon. So yeah, you take that back to the village.
Let's think about what you've done and what people listening take from this. We're about to go into another Olympics and you'll be working there. Excitingly, you'll be working for Team GB and you're doing some commentary work as well for Eurosport. Imagine there's a little girl, 14 years old, like you were that day of the double math lesson you didn't go to. And she's listening to this podcast with her mum or her dad. Mm-hmm. What do you say to her about sport and the Olympic dream?
I would say don't be afraid to try something different. Like, go out of your comfort zone, take opportunities. Opportunities aren't always going to land on your lap. I feel very much like it almost did for me in terms of them coming to my school, but it still had to, you know, I still had to go out there and put on my PE kit and miss a maths lesson and go and give it a go. And, you know, if I hadn't have given it a go, I would never have in a million years discovered cycling or joined a cycling club and got myself into track cycling. So opportunities, you know, take them, try different things. You never know what sport you're going to either enjoy or be really good at, or hopefully both, without trying it. And there's so many different sports in the Olympics now. We've got skateboarding, we've got breakdancing, all sorts of different things coming into Paris. Don't be afraid to be bad at something. When I first started cycling, the story of Epping Forest mountain bike ride, that was, you know, not a lot of fun. I wasn't very good. I wasn't looking like a talented cyclist at that point. But you never know sort of, you know, how you can improve rapidly. And it's okay to be bad at something. It's okay to fail as long as you have a go.
A lot of girls drop out of sport and tell us they drop out of sport because they don't like being watched. They don't like being looked at. And there's a real culture of that. I guess it's partly to do with social media, but girls feel watched. How do we tackle that? You work at Women in Sport. You know these statistics as well as I do. From your point of view, you had to be watched. There was no way of doing what you were doing without millions of people around the world watching you. What's your message to girls about that fear of being watched?
Yeah, I think it is a really difficult one. And I think also it's a very different world we live in now with social media the way it is. You know, social media was in its infancy back when I was sort of getting into cycling. But I think the importance of focusing on yourself, focusing on the things that you can control, focusing on your own targets and trying to look at your own improvement. And it's really, really hard when you do feel judged. And, you know, a lot of sports are, you know, depending where they're taking place, you can feel very exposed. But go to a place that you feel safe. Go with friends, go with family. You don't have to be out there in a really exposed situation. You know, there are very welcoming sports clubs in all sorts of different sports, and, you know, seek out those opportunities where you do feel safe. And the most important thing is that you enjoy it. And if you're not enjoying it, then you're not going to progress. So number one, find something that you enjoy with people that you enjoy going with. And you can all hold each other to account then. You know, you can all go together to whatever club or whatever event you're going to. And I think that makes it far more enjoyable.
Okay, really quick fire round of Olympic questions.
Oh, here we go.
Your best moment?
Must have been winning the gold in Rio as opposed to London, because that was the tougher one.
Your worst Olympic moment?
Probably, so in Rio, we had qualifier day one. Day two was a day off, and then day three was semi-final and final. So that day in between qualifier and semi-final, just a full day to really just overthink, how do my legs feel? And you can't relax, you can't enjoy anything, you're completely in competition mode, and you're just thinking about, do I do a little bit extra on my bike today? Do I rest completely? Do I need to go for a little walk? Do I need to eat more? Do I need to be more hydrated? So that was a very big overthinking day. A lot of listening to music that day, trying to sort of get lost in that.
Your favourite Olympian of all time?
Oh, my favourite Olympian of all time. I'm going to go Chris Hoy. Just because he's not anymore, but he was the greatest ever British Olympian in terms of his medal count, and just a really, really lovely guy, and still in and around the sport. I still do see him in velodromes very regularly, and yeah, just a really all-round awesome guy.
After cycling, the best Olympic event?
Oh, I love athletics. There's a lot of parallels to track cycling in terms of track and field, so I really love that. I love all the records around it.
Okay, and what are you most looking forward to? Paris 2024?
I'm most looking forward to the track cycling events in Paris, particularly day one of the track cycling. We have high hopes for GB to win the women's team sprint, and that's an event we didn't qualify for at the previous two Olympic Games, and we are now favourites to win this time around. So high hopes for those girls.
Okay, and finally, sum the Olympics up in a sentence. Why does it matter?
At the end of the day, it's all about the best in the world winning those events, but it is about the showcase to everyone around the globe and everybody be able to see all those sports, see these fantastic athletes that are competing in their sport year in, year out. But it's about it all coming together, all the nations coming together and showcasing sport to the rest of the world.
Joanna Rousel, thank you so much for talking to us about your Olympic experiences. That's it for this episode of the Women in Sport podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. My thanks to my guest and colleague, Jo Rousel. And if you're in the mood for more Olympic tales, listen to our episode with Tessa Sanderson or delve into our archive of dozens of interviews and discussions about women in sport. Please remember to like, subscribe and rate wherever you get your podcasts. Do go to our website, womeninsport.org, where you can sign up to our newsletter, donate to the charity and get involved in our work. You can find us on all the usual socials, so follow us and tell us what sports you love and what you are doing to create change. Thank you to Whistledown Productions in London, where this podcast was recorded. And thanks to you for listening. My name is Julia George. Remember, everyone should be included in the joy, fulfillment, and lifelong benefits of sport. See you next time.